Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Got my mojo working,
but just don't work on you. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have so much to share. The latest, of course, on health and healing. And so many women in America are looking at dealing with menopause in a more natural way, and that's very positive. And I'll deal with that and try to give some insights as to what women who are going through menopausal symptoms can change. Also, University of California has a new study about brain inflammation triggered by chronic pain to anxiety and depression. So we'll talk about that and how we can change the model that we're using to treat people with pain and anxiety and depression to prevent them from losing their memory. Also, we'll talk about the role of estrogen in cervical cancer and a whole lot more involving health and healing. And then from our environmental segment today, California is sinking and it's getting worse. And we'll talk about why is that important. Well, someone could say, well, that doesn't impact me. Yes, it does. I'll explain why. From Ralph Nader, 10 reasons the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not progressive. Also, the EPA says fracking pollutes our water. And then we're going to have a special in-depth investigative report, part one today. Medical miracles or medical frauds? The smallpox and polio vaccines. The pro-vaccine individuals have used smallpox and polio as examples of why it is irresponsible to disallow the power of vaccines. Okay? What if they're wrong? Why haven't the scholars, the researchers, the people who have the ability to look into history done their homework? We have, and today, a two-part series on what we found. And this should help the people in California and other states who are now being told that they must mandate vaccines. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. And I will also be doing part two of our special report on tomorrow's program. I'm asked all the time, what role does charcoal have in helping with health? Well, there's two things charcoal can do. First, if you have a lot of gas, by taking 5 to 10 charcoal capsules, activated charcoal, it's very important because food-grade charcoal is derived from burning pure, untainted organic substances like coconuts or certain woods without using toxic chemicals in the process. And charcoal forms a chemical bond with heavy metals, and that allows these metals and toxins to be flushed from the body. Quote, the action of activated charcoal involves absorption, not absorption of toxins. Absorption is the electrical attraction of toxins and heavy metals, but not beneficial nutrients, to the surface of the fine charcoal particles. This is more of a chelation process. The charcoal itself is not absorbed into the body, so the toxins attached to the charcoal particles exit via the bowels. And as a result, you end up with very discolored blackish stools, end quote, Natural Society. So getting rid of toxins in the diet, that will help. If you have food poisoning, you definitely want to use charcoal about every 2 hours, about 10 charcoal capsules. It can help flush the toxins out, but then you want to take something like aloe vera and drink it about every hour. That can help in the healing process, and as well as marshmallow root. Now, we also know that vitamin C helps get rid of toxins in the body, but if you have a simple glass, 3 to 4 ounces a day, this is one of the best ways in the world to keep yourself detoxed. The reality is not everyone is able to get in the hands of a qualified nutritionist or a dietitian or a holistic doctor and to detox, or to go away to a detox retreat. So here's something you can do. If you do it on a daily basis, you'll really clean out your system. You take 2 ounces of wheatgrass juice, add in 1 ounce of ginger juice, and 2 ounces of lemon juice. Mix that with a teaspoon of spirulina and a teaspoon of chlorella and a quarter teaspoon of vitamin C. And then you dilute that in 16 ounces of cabbage juice. So that's your stay-at-home detox cleansing that'll help get rid of heavy metals and clean up your intestines. It's terrific for you. And people with cancer, diabetes, heart disease, it's good for you as well. But let's say that you are overweight and you're diabetic and you have neuropathy, then take yourself an Epsom salts bath in the evening, warm water, put in 1 gallon of Epsom salts. Epsom salts, you can get a bag for a couple bucks. It's very inexpensive. And that helps in a half hour to pull toxins from the body and cleanses out through the skin. So have yourself some form of exfoliating material. There's little mittens you can buy and you put on, and they can help exfoliate your skin. And that helps the glands and the organs carry away toxins and pathogens. So that's something you could do each night. Only takes about 20 minutes to 30 minutes. So not difficult to start your own detox protocol. I have 3 major films and 3 major books all coming out over the next year. And in one of the books, I have a big section on menopause because I finished a major study on menopause using almost 300 women for a year in this study, lifestyle and behavior modification study. And they were able to make major improvements with the symptoms they have. So now we're finding that more and more women, because of the women's health movement and a lot of women's voices that are out there within the different communities, are suggesting before you use synthetic hormone replacement therapy to turn off your hot flashes or night sweats, use something that's natural and non-toxic, like, for example, very easy, squalvine, Vitex, black cohosh, blue cohosh, Dong Quai, very inexpensive, easy, and healthy herbs to use. And also get rid of the coffee. I have found more women able to remove fibrocystic breast and fibroids by giving up caffeine and giving up all pro-inflammatory foods, dairy in particular. So give that up and it can make an enormous difference. But a new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause shows that, quote, the use of complementary and alternative medicine is increasing for the treatment of menopausal symptoms, and that's good. So more women are realizing they don't have to suffer from any of the nearly 60 different symptoms they can find. This is from the University of California at Irvine, and it says that brain inflammation caused by chronic nerve pain alters activity in regions that regulate mood and motivation, suggesting for the first time that a direct biophysical link exists between long-term pain and the depression, anxiety, and substance abuse seen in more and more of these patients. This according to University of California, Irvine researchers. So let's put this in proper perspective. According to the Institute of Medicine, and by the way, the Institute of Medicine is the U.S. government's official medical repository of what works, what doesn't work, they estimate the cost to our society each year of chronic pain, $635 billion. Billion. Almost $1 trillion. Wow. So using natural techniques to deal with pain is essential. Because if we don't deal with pain and it so affects the quality of life, then you're more likely to use some form of narcotic that will help you bear the pain, and then you no longer rely upon the body's natural healing. And then that's how people get addicted. And that's how it can adversely affect their life. But this also is saying when you're in this kind of chronic pain, it creates anxiety and depression. And that's a double negative. This was published in the journal Neuroscience. Also, a new study redefines the role of estrogen in cervical cancer. This is from the University of Wisconsin. Quote, scientists have prior evidence that the hormone estrogen is a major driver in the growth of cervical cancer. But a new study examining genetic profiles in 128 clinical cases reached a surprising conclusion. Estrogen receptors all but vanished in cervical cancer tumors. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Virtually all cervical cancers derive from human papillomavirus infections. The specimens in the study came from four distinct groups. Now, what does this mean in lay language? It means that we should be very conscious of the sources of our estrogen. If you're getting your estrogen from protein, and if you are overweight, which drives estrogen, and if you are anxious or depressed, which can drive estrogen, then you're getting estrogen in an imbalanced way. But if you're getting estrogen-like chemicals from vegetables, that's healthy. As a result, you want healthy estrogen in the right balance to progesterone, and you do not want the unhealthy estrogens that derive from animal-based diet. And finally, from the health segment today, the health benefits of propolis. Now, propolis is also known as bee glue. It's a resinous substance that produced by honeybees from the tree buds and sap. It's used to seal small spaces in the hive, which protects the bees from wind, rain, and animal intrusion. Growing up in a small community in West Virginia, I never saw a single person use either natural honey or bee propolis or pollen. But in the country, everybody had a little jar of this very dark, it's almost black salve. Cuts, scrapes, abscesses, tooth problems, gum problems. I saw them put it on everything. But also I saw them using it. I knew people who use bee propolis every morning. They would make a tea and put the bee propolis in it. Well, they were right. The use of propolis goes back to the ancient Greeks and Assyrians, who knew of its wound-healing properties. It was also used by the Egyptians in the embalming process. Why is it important? Because it has very strong natural antibacterial and antiviral properties. It's also rich in polyphenols and flavonoids, and those are the healing compounds in plants. It's a flavonoid, and it's linked with its antibacterial effects. In fact, studies have shown that it can kill Staphylococcus aureus and MRSA infections. And this antibacterial property is responsible in part for an ability to protect against dental cavities. And propolis flavonoids also appear to be effective against herpes and some fungi. And now there's new studies showing it's effective against cancer. So on all levels, it is good. And it's good for your teeth, too. And it heals wounds. If you have any wound, by the way, if you have a wound that's not healing after, let's say, 6 weeks, and even if it starts to look like it's healing and you're starting to get some new tissue, but then it never quite heals, go to a dermatologist to make sure that it's not cancer. Because cancer is not always brown or black. Cancer could be an unhealed wound anywhere on the body. And especially for the baby boomer generation that were out in the sun so much, I have yet to see someone over the age of 40 who didn't have precancerous lesions on their body, generally on the neck, the face, the hands, or the arms. And I believe that you should have two examinations a year. And generally what will happen is you might have a basal cell or a squamous cell. Those are not going to kill you, and they're slow growing. But what generally will happen is your dermatologist will take a look, and if they suspect anything, they'll take a little scraping, and then within a day or two, they'll get the results back, and they'll say, okay, this is a cancer, and we should take care of it. What that means is that they'll give you a little bit of local anesthetic, and then they will burn it out, and then they will scrape it out. And then in time that heals over, and at least you don't have to worry about having that problem. It's when all the people out there don't go to the dermatologist, don't look for these on their body, or think that I've had it for a while, it's not a problem. If you have it for a while, get it removed. That's my advice. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to go to our environmental segment. We have two things to share with you. The first is from EcoWatch, and it deals with an EP study. For those of us who've been trying to get communities to say no to hydrofracking, irrespective of the contracts that have been signed, because if you find that you've signed a contract so that a fracking company controls your water, but if you also find out that any of the products that they're using is polluting your water and causing adverse health effects to animals or humans, you have the right to sue them. And more often than not, the courts will have a put a moratorium on them from doing any more fracking. This is the latest. Quote, in 2010, Congress commissioned U.S. EPA to study the impact of fracking on drinking water. The U.S. EPA released its long-awaited final draft of this report today, assessing how fracking for oil and gas can impact access to safe drinking water. The report refuted the conclusion arrived at by the U.S.'s EPA 2004 study that fracking poses no threat to drinking water, a conclusion used to exempt the fracking process from the Safe Drinking Water Act. The report found that fracking for shale oil and gas has not led to, quote, widespread systemic impacts on drinking water resources in the United States, but said fracking could contaminate drinking water under certain conditions, such as when fluids used in the process leaked into the water table and found isolated cases of water contamination. So no longer do they have a clean bill of health. That's important, and I'll post that so you can use that. Also, in California, not only are they suffering from severe drought that will not get better in the near future, but they have a problem. And the problem is they have water from wells. They have water from the Little Colorado by treaty. And they have water coming from the Sierra Nevadas in the northeastern part of the state that comes through a 450-mile canal that was built some years ago. That's the three principal sources of their water. The surface water, that which is in visible reservoirs, that's virtually gone. It doesn't exist anymore. The lower wells, those are almost all gone, which means the water that does exist, you have to dig deeper, which is very expensive. And the water's coming in out of the canal far less than normal, and the Little Colorado as well. So that means that you have too little water for 38 million people, including the biggest users of water, the cattle industry, the dairy industry from the cattle industry, but cattle for meat and cattle for dairy, big users. Also, huge users are cotton and alfalfa. As crops, cotton and alfalfa use more water than any other plant. And then almonds are behind that. And yet, all these are exempt. None of those have really had a problem. The problem occurs when the water that was there is no longer there, and therefore you have to kill off your orchard. They literally go in and they uproot the trees and taking out maybe 100 acres or 1,000 acres at a time. So some water that is left goes for the remaining trees. So what you have is you have about 500,000 acres taken out of production this last year alone. Still, there's millions of acres, so they still have plenty that they can use. The problem is, where are you going to get your water in the future? So the water is being pumped out at an enormous rate, and people have been asked to make lifestyle modification. Now, the people of California actually don't use that much water compared to agriculture and mining, which uses most of it. So here's what is happening. As you pull water out of the ground, the water no longer is there as a a balance to the gravitational fields. Hence, it creates a vacuum. It creates a cavity. And now the ground above begins to sink into that cavity. And the whole state is sinking. This is from Nathan Halverson from The Reveler. Quote, California is sinking and fast. While the state's drought-induced sinking is well known, new details highlight just how severe it has become and how little the government has done to monitor it. Last summer, scientists recorded the worst sinking in at least 50 years. This summer, all-time records are expected across the state as thousands of miles of land in the Central Valley and elsewhere sink. But the extent of the problem and how much it will cost taxpayers to fix are part of the mystery of the state's unfolding drought. No agency is tracking the sinking statewide. Little public money has been put aside to study it, and California allows agriculture businesses to keep crucial parts of their operations secret. The cause is known. People are pulling unsustainable amounts of water out of underground aquifers, primarily for food production, with water sucked out to irrigate crops, a practice that has accelerated during the drought. Tens of thousands of square miles are deflating like a leaking air mattress, inch by inch. Groundwater now supplies about 60% of the state's water, with the vast majority of that going to agriculture. Tens of thousands of groundwater pumps run day and night, sucking up about 5% of the state's total electricity. And that's an increase of 40% over normal years. And the sinking is starting to destroy bridges, crack irrigation canals, and twist highways across the state, according to U.S. Geological Survey. Two bridges in Fresno County, an area that produces about 15% of the world's almonds, have sunk so much that they are nearly underwater and will cost millions to rebuild. Nearby, an elementary school is slowly descending into a miles-long sinkhole that will make it susceptible to future flooding. Private businesses are on the hook, too. One canal system is facing more than $60 million in repairs because one of its dams is sinking, and public and private water wells are being bent and disfigured like crumbling drinking straws as the earth collapses around them. The sinking has a technical name, subsistence, and it occurs when aquifers are drained of water and the land collapses down where the water used to be. The last comprehensive survey of sinking in the late 70s, and it's much worse now. Some places in the state are sinking more than a foot per year, and it's going to cost billions of dollars to fix. How a legendary hydrologist solved the mystery. In the 1920s, farmers began transforming desert lands into verdant crops, fields, by pumping groundwater to the surface. At the time, these farmers were not just head and shoulders above their modern-day counterparts, they were actually as much as three stories above them, but then the land started to sink. In the 1930s, scientists first noticed the land was sinking. At the time, the cause was a mystery. A legendary hydrologist, Joseph Polan, was assigned to solve the puzzle starting in the 1940s. He realized that underneath the sinking land, groundwater was being pumped rapidly to irrigate crops. It created massive sinkholes that stretched for miles in every direction. In the farming community of Bedota, the land sunk about 30 feet. The sinkhole was so vast that it's essentially impossible for residents to see that they are standing in one. Polan used a utility pole to build a temporary monument to show just how much the land had sunk. The sinking, which peaked in the 1960s, wreaked havoc on the state's rapidly expanding infrastructure, damaging highways, bridges, and irrigation canals. One estimate by the California Water Foundation put the price tag at $1.3 billion for just some of the repairs at that time. And now it's worse than ever before. So, what it means in lay language is that you're going to start to find that a lot of the infrastructure, like electric lines and gas lines, are now sometimes 18 inches in 1 year out of the ground. Whole lines. Well, that's really dangerous. You can't have exposed gas lines that could cause explosions. Electric lines the same way. And these utility poles are going to start falling on roads. Bridges are going to buckle and no longer become safe. So this is going to only accelerate and get worse. I believe, based upon a conversation I had last week with someone who just returned from an affluent area of California, that massive amounts of homes are up for sale. And not because these people are in foreclosure, but because the value of their property is going to drop like a lead balloon once people start migrating out of the state. I believe that everything will be done to try to keep people in the state and mitigate the disaster of fires, earthquake, sinking land, and drought. It won't work. And the wealthier upper-middle-class people, being more educated, they're going to be quietly selling off their gated community homes on golf courses because all the golf courses are going to end up being affected. Now, not all of them will go dry. They'll just have to pay a lot more for the water to use on their golf courses. And golf courses are one of the most voracious users of water. So you're going to see a lot of golf courses and gated communities simply dry up. And then their house is going to plummet by 50, 60, 70%. Who wants to buy a house on a golf course where you can't play golf in now or in the future? Who wants to be on a man-made lake when the lake is a dry mud hole? So I believe in the next 2 years you're going to see the beginning of a mass exodus out of California. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. I was just informed that our premiere is sold out. Sorry for those who did not have a chance to call in, but all of the premieres are always sold out. What you can do now is you can get on a waiting list. It's this coming Wednesday at 6 p.m. No tickets will be sold at the door, none. This is a major theater in New York City, and we're premiering the film, which has taken 4 years to produce, Saving the Planet. You won't want to miss it. It's a powerful film. But get on a waiting list, because there's always a certain number of people who absolutely positively think they're going to come, but for some reason can't. So when we have an opening, we'll call you. Right now we are full. Call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and hopefully we can get some of you in. There's always going to be some people who don't show up, all right? Now I'm going to take a few moments and share part one of an original investigative report entitled Medical Miracles or Medical Fraud, the Smallpox and Polio Vaccine Issues. During the past several months, as a slew of draconian vaccine bills have been aggressively pushed upon state legislators to legally enforce vaccination against Americans' freedom of choice, I've had the opportunity to debate publicly pro-vaccine advocates. When faced with a barrage of peer-reviewed scientific facts confirming vaccines' failures and lack of efficacy and safety, Representatives of the vaccine establishment will inevitably raise the issue of the eradication of polio and smallpox as case examples of two vaccine miracles. Yet neither case has there been scientifically sound confirmation that the demise of these two infectious diseases were the result of mass population vaccine campaigns. Seem impossible with all the pro-vaccine propaganda? These are almost considered sacrosanct. You cannot challenge the polio and the smallpox vaccines. They eradicated diseases that impacted millions of people. But it didn't happen. Not the way they told us. Furthermore, this horribly simplistic belief that polio and smallpox are exemplary models for all other vaccines is both naive and dangerous. Vaccinology does not follow a one-size-fits-all theory as the pro-vaccine industry propagates to the public. For any coherent public debate, it is necessary for each vaccine to be critically discerned upon its own terms with respect to its rate of efficacy, the properties of viral infection, and immune response. Vaccines' adverse effects and the long-term risks that may not present symptoms until years after inoculation. This report is in two parts. Today, part one, where I will challenge the pro-vaccine industry and show you how to deconstruct the false claims of polio and smallpox as modern medical success stories and put each in its historical and scientific perspective. The legacy of the polio vaccine and its ongoing track record of failure, particularly in developing nations, will be presented now. And it's a very dangerous assumption to believe that any new vaccine or drug to fight an infectious disease or life-threatening disease will be safe once released upon an uninformed public. The history of pharmaceutical science is largely a story of failures, with some successes. Numerous drugs over the decades have been approved and found more dangerous than the condition being targeted, but only after hundreds of thousands to millions to tens of millions of people were turned into guinea pigs by the medical establishment. In the case of vaccines, both the first human papilloma vaccine, Gardasil, and the rotavirus, Rotatec, were disasters. Both were fast-tracked through the FDA, and both failed to live up to their promises. This scenario of fast-tracking unsafe and poorly researched vaccines was certainly the case for one of the first polio vaccines in 1955. In fact, the polio vaccine received FDA approval and licensure after 2 hours. You heard me correctly, 2 hours of review. That's the fastest approval of any drug in U.S. history. It was known as the Cutter Incident, that's C-U-T-T-E-R, because the vaccine was manufactured by Cutter Laboratories. Within days, 40,000 children were left with polio because of the vaccine. That's 40,000. 200 with severe paralysis and 10 deaths. Shortly thereafter, the vaccine was very quickly withdrawn from circulation and abandoned. Where is that shared in any discourse on the issue of public safety of vaccines? Not a word anywhere, and yet it's a matter of historical fact. The CDC's website still promulgates a blatant untruth that the Salk vaccine was a modern medical success. To the contrary, officials at the National Institutes of Health were convinced that the vaccine was contributing to a rise in polio and paralysis cases in the 1950s. In 1957, Edward McBean documented in his book, The Poison Needle, the government officials stated that the vaccine, quote, was worthless as a preventative and dangerous to take. Some states, such as Idaho, where several people died after receiving the Salk vaccine, wanted to hold the vaccine maker legally liable. Dr. Salk himself testified in 1976 that his live virus vaccine, which continued to be distributed in the United States until the year 2000, was, quote, principal, if not sole cause, of all polio cases in the United States since 1961. However, after much lobbying and political leveraging, private industry seduced the U.S. Public Health Service to proclaim the vaccine safe. but the inventor said otherwise. It's a matter of public record. Now, although this occurred in the 1950s, the same private industry game plan to coerce and buy off government health agencies has become epidemic with practically every vaccine brought to market during the past 50 years. Today, U.S. authorities proudly claim the nation is polio-free. Medical authorities and advocates of mass vaccination raise the polio vaccine as an example of a vaccine that eradicated a virus and proof of the unfounded herd immunity theory. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, a nephrologist and one of today's most outspoken medical critics against vaccines, has documented thoroughly that the polio's disappearance was actually a game of smoke and mirrors. By 1961, the polio vaccine should have been ruled a dismal failure and abandoned since more people were being paralyzed from the vaccines than wild poliovirus infections. In the 1950s, it marked a decade of remarkable medical achievement. It also marked a period of high scientific naivety and enthusiastic idealism. Paralysis was not only associated with polio infections, but also a wide variety of other biological and toxic agents: aseptic meningitis, Coxsackie virus, echoviruses, arsenic, DDT, and other industrial chemicals were toxic and indiscriminately used upon hundreds of millions of people. In addition, paralytic conditions were given a variety of names in an attempt to distinguish them, although some, such as paralysis due to polio, aseptic meningitis, and Coxsackie, were indistinguishable. One of the more devious names was acute flaccid paralysis, or AFP, a class of paralysis indistinguishable from the paralysis occurring in thousands within the vaccinated population. It was therefore incumbent upon health authorities to transfer polio vaccine-related injuries to the non-polio virus causation in order to salvage vaccination campaigns and relieve public fears. Dr. Humphreys and her colleagues have noted a direct relationship between the increase in the flaccid paralysis group, acute flaccid paralysis group, through 2011, and government claims of declining polio infection rates parallel with increased vaccination. So it was smoke and mirrors. One of the largest, most devious medical scandals in the history of American medicine also concerns the polio vaccine. In An Excellent History About the Polio Vaccine, Neil Miller shares the stories of Dr. Bernice Eddy, a scientist at the National Institutes of Health, who in 1959, quote, discovered that the polio vaccines being administered throughout the world contain an infectious agent capable of causing cancer. As the story is told, her attempts to warn federal officials resulted in the removal of her laboratory and being demoted at the agency. It was only later that one of the nation's most famous vaccine developers, the father of American vaccines, Maurice Hilleman, at Merck, identified the agent as a cancer-causing monkey virus, SV40, common in almost all rhesus monkeys being used to culture the poliovirus for the vaccine. This contaminant virus was found in all samples of the Sabin oral polio vaccine tested. The virus was also being found in Salk's killed polio injectable vaccine as well. No one knows for certain how many Americans received the SV40 contaminated vaccines, but some estimates put the figure as high as 100 million people. That was greater than half the U.S. population in 1963 when the vaccine was removed from the market. Now, many Americans today, even more around the world, continue to be threatened and suffer from the legacy of this lethal vaccine. Among some of the more alarming discoveries since the discovery of the SV40 vaccine and Salk's and Sabin's vaccines and its carcinogenic footprint in millions of Americans today are: Loyola University Medical Center identified SV40 in 38% of bone cancer cases. 58% of mesothelioma cases, a life-threatening lung cancer, had SV40 present. A later analysis of a large national cancer database found mesotheliomas were 178% higher among those who received the polio vaccines. A study published in Cancer Research found SV40 in 23% of blood samples taken and 45% of semen samples studied thereby confirming that the monkey virus can be sexually transmitted. Osteosarcomas are 10 times higher in states where the polio vaccine contaminated with SV40 was most used, particularly throughout the northeastern states. Two 1988 studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine discovered that the SV40 can be passed on to infants whose mothers received the SV40-tainted vaccines. Those children later had a 1,300% greater rate of brain tumors compared to children whose mothers did not receive the polio vaccines. This would also explain why these children's tumors contain the SV40 virus, even though the children themselves did not get vaccinated. There's a large body of scientific literature detailing the catastrophic consequences of the SV40 virus infection. As of 2001, the peer-reviewed literature contained 62 studies confirming the presence of the SV40 in a variety of human tissues and different carcinomas. Although the killed polio vaccine administered in developed nations no longer contained the SV40 virus, the oral vaccine continues to be the vaccine of choice in poor developing countries because it costs less to manufacture. Safety is clearly not a priority of the drug companies and health agencies and bureaucratic organizations that push the vaccine on impoverished children. After almost 60 years of silence and a federally sanctioned cover-up, the CDC finally admitted several years ago that the Salk and Sabin vaccines indeed were contaminated with the carcinogenic SV40 monkey virus. However, the SV40 is not the only contaminant parents should be worried about. As with other vaccines such as measles, mumps, influenza, smallpox, the viral component of the vaccine continues to be cultured in animal cell medium. And this medium can contain monkey kidney cells, newborn calf serum, bovine extract. More recently, it is a causative agent for tetanus infection, which is the tetany. All animal tissue mediums can carry known and unknown pathogenic viruses and bacterial genetic residues and foreign DNA fragments that pose countless potential health risks. Based upon transcripts of CDC meetings on biological safety, the late medical investigative reporter Janine Roberts noted that vaccine makers and government health officials admit they have no way to prevent dangerous carcinogenic and autoimmune causative genetic material from being injected into an infant. Among the unwanted genetic materials that might be found in vaccines today are cancer-causing oncogenes, bird leukemia virus, equine arthritic virus, prions, and by the way, prions are responsible for mad cow disease, enzyme reverse transcriptase, and a multitude of extraneous DNA fragments and contaminants that escape filtration during the vaccine preparation. The CDC acknowledged that it is impossible to remove all foreign genetic and viral material from vaccines. As Janine Roberts noted, the science behind the manufacture of vaccines is extraordinarily primitive. Therefore, the CDC sets limits on how much genetic contamination by weight is permitted in a vaccine, and the agency over the years continues to increase the threshold. And amidst the polio vaccine debacle and mounds of scientific literature confirming the vaccine's failure, U.S. health agencies and the most ardent proponents of vaccine, such as Bill Gates, retreat into the protected cloisters of medical denialism and continue to spew folktales of polio's vaccine success. The polio vaccines on the market have not improved very much in the past 60 years. They continue to rely upon primitive manufacturing technology and animal tissue culturing. In recent years, Bill Gates' polio eradication campaign in India have been not just a failure, but a deadly failure. Touted as, quote, one of the most expensive public health campaigns in history, according to Bloomberg Business, as many as 15 doses of oral polio vaccine failed to immunize the poorest of Indian children. Severe gastrointestinal damage due to contaminated water and wretched sanitation conditions have made the vaccine ineffective. Similar cases have been reported with the rotavirus and cholera vaccines, failures in Brazil, Peru, and Bangladesh. According to epidemiologist Nicholas Grassley at Imperial College London, quote, there's an increasing evidence that the oral polio failure is a result of exposure to other gut infections, end quote. There's another even more frightening consequence of Bill Gates' vaccine boondoggle launched upon rural India in 2011. This particular polio vaccine contains an increased dosage of the poliovirus. In the April-June 2012 issue of the Indian Journal of Medical Ethics, a paper reported the incidence of 47,500 new cases of what is being termed non-polio acute flaccid paralysis. With this non-polio acute flaccid paralysis follows the Gates polio campaign. The following year, there were over 53,500 cases of the non-polio acute flaccid paralysis reported. And it's clinically indistinguishable from wild polio paralysis as well as polio vaccine-induced paralysis. The primary difference is that the non-polio acute flaccid paralysis is far more fatal. Now, physicians at New Delhi St. Stephen's Hospital analyzed national polio surveillance data and found direct links between the increased dosages of the polio vaccine given by Bill Gates' foundation and the rise in this type of paralysis. Coincidentally, the two states with the highest number of cases, Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, are also the two states with the worst water contamination, poverty, and the highest rates of gastrointestinal diseases, reported by Bloomberg. As early as 1948, during a particularly terrible polio outbreak in the U.S., Dr. Benjamin Sandler at Aten Veterans Hospital observed the relationship between polio infection, malnutrition, poor diets, relying heavily on starches. According to nutritional data, white rice, primarily daily food staple among poor Indians, has the highest starch content of almost all the foods they consume. So despite this crisis, in January 2014, Bill Gates and the World Health Organization and the Indian government announced India is today a polio-free nation, although sleight-of-hand performance of the polio's vaccine's magical act. Are you really sure that it was the vaccine? Because everywhere you gave that vaccine, we have in 1 year 47,500 new cases of paralysis, the next year 53,500 cases of paralysis. No, there are those who say your vaccine caused nearly 100,000 Indians to become paralyzed and countless ones to die. All you have to do is just change the name to non-polio acute flaccid paralysis, the game that they play in the lives that are impacted. According to statistics compiled by Neil Miller, director of the Think Twice Global Vaccine Institute, the polio death rate has declined by 47% from 1923 to when the vaccine was introduced in 1953. In the United Kingdom, the rate declined 55%, and similar rates were observed in other European countries. And many historians of science, such as Robert Johnson, the University of Illinois, agree that the decrease in polio and other infectious diseases during the first half of the 20th century was largely the result of concerted national public health efforts to improve sanitation, clean up the water system, get rid of overcrowded conditions, child labor conditions, better hygienic food processing, and new advances in medicine and healthcare. That is what happened. Rely upon the unfounded myth that vaccines are a magic bullet to protect a population suffering from extreme conditions of poverty while failing to improve those conditions is a no-win scenario. Vaccines will continue to fail and further endanger the millions of children's health with severely impaired immune systems with high levels of vaccine infectious agents and other toxic ingredients. And a further question that has arisen in recent years is whether or not a new, more deadly poliovirus has begun to merge as a result of over-vaccination. Last year, researchers at the University of Bonn isolated a new strain of poliovirus that evades vaccine protection. During a 2010 polio outbreak in a vaccinated region of the Congo, there were 445 cases of polio paralysis and 209 cases of death. This is only the most recent report of poliovirus strains mutation that calls the entire medical edifice of the vaccine efficacy into question. And one of the first discoveries of the vaccine contributing to the rise of new polio strains was reported by the Institute of Pasteur in 1993. Dr. Krennic at the Institute proved that if you vaccinate a person with three strains of poliovirus, a fourth strain will emerge, and therefore the vaccine itself is contributing to the recombinant activity between strains. Moreover, since the poliovirus is excreted through a person's GI system, it is commonly present in sewage and then water sources. In 200, Japanese scientists discovered a new infectious polio strain in rivers and sewage near Tokyo. After genetic sequencing, the novel mutation was able to be traced back to the polio vaccine. Additional vaccine-derived polio strains have also been identified in Egypt, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. Therefore, the emergence of a new polio strain due to over-vaccination is predictable. Similar developments are being discovered with a new pertussis strain that evades the current DPT vaccines. For this reason, there has been an increase in whooping cough outbreaks among fully vaccinated children, and influenza viruses regularly mutate and evade current vaccine flu vaccines. The measles vaccine is becoming less and less effective, and again, measles outbreaks are occurring among some of the most highly vaccinated populations. As with the failure of antibiotics because of their over-reliance to infectious diseases, researchers are now more readily willing to entertain the likelihood that massive vaccination campaigns are actually contributing to the emergence of new, more deadly viral strains impervious to current vaccines. Even if a person were to make the wild assumption that polio vaccines were responsible for the eradication of polio infections in the United States, what has been the trade-off? According to the American Cancer Society, in 2013, over 1.6 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer, and 24 million Americans have autoimmune diseases. How many of these may be related to the polio and other vaccines? There's no way of assuring the public the truth. Nevertheless, it is certain that it is a question that American health officials and vaccine companies are fearful to have answered. I'm Gary Nall, and that's part one of a special investigative report on vaccines. Part two will continue tomorrow. Let me also mention that, unfortunately, our recent fundraising on WBI New York, our sister station, was not successful. We were not able to bring in $20,000 a day. It became under $10,000 a day. So we have a great shortfall. Our premiere this week will certainly help, but in order to help the station buy premiums from different vendors for different programs on the station, we are doing a retreat the second week of August, a health retreat, one that will provide people with an opportunity to relax, de-stress, detoxify. And it is in a beautiful environment. And I think I can think of no better way for you to get back on your feet and get healthy, or if you are healthy, become healthier than to attend. Listen to some of the testimonials of people who attended the one that was earlier this year.
My name is Jim. I enjoyed my week here at Garrett's Retreat. I wish I could stay another week. I learned a lot about nature and its balance and keeping things in harmony. I have a lot of tools I will take home with me as far as gardening, cooking, and exercise. Thank you.
My name is Linda. It's an experience for me to be in this retreat. I take home with me when I leave here. I felt energy, peacefulness, and calmness within myself. I also experienced a talent I didn't know I had in the art class. I thank the chefs for delicious meals that they had prepared for us. And I'm also thank the wonderful people that we met here, and I thank Gary ever so much.
Oh, hi, my name is Michael. I just finished a one-week retreat. I'm a chef, and I was diagnosed with high blood pressure, several years ago. On medication, my pressure, the best I got was 140 over 80. After being here for 2 days, you know, experiencing the yoga, the exercise class, the delicious food that, you know, has been prepared by the chef, You know, on Wednesday, I checked my pressure, and it was 128 over 80 without medication. So I'm really glad that I was able to come here and experience this life-transforming experience. And I recommend this to anyone who wants to get healthy and to live a good lifestyle.
Hi, my name is Julie. Everything that I've seen is so beautiful. All the classes that he has for you are just fantastic. And the chefs that provide the food for you is just awesome. And I've lost weight here. My husband told me, come on, let's go. So I came, and he said, well, it'll be good for you. Well, I've lost weight, and I really feel good, and I'm very energy. And thank you, Gary, for having us here.
Hello, my name is Lloyd, and this is the third experience I've had with Gary in regards to retreats. And I must say that they just get better and better. And I strongly advise anyone who wants to make a major change in life to seek the retreats out. And I'm thankful to Gary, especially for his spiritual input that has made a significant difference in my life. Very positive. Thank you very much.
My name is Priscilla Brown, and I just spent a week with Gary Knowles at a health retreat, and it was so awesome. We met so many positive people. The experience was beautiful. You saw different types of birds and butterflies. The food was unbelievable. I enjoyed it.
Those are just some of the people who had life-transforming experiences. So if you'd like to give yourself a week in paradise to detox, heal, rejuvenate, de-stress, enjoy nature, be at peace with yourself, learn so much, give a call. Here's the number. And the number is 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to having a good show following this, and I'll be back tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.